Thanks for coming out. This meeting's getting a lot of support lately. That's really exciting, at least for me. And just for anybody that hasn't been here before, I'll give just a brief background on how this meeting came to be. About 5 years ago, I started meeting with my sponsees and some of the people that they brought along at my house to go through the Big Book and to basically instruct in how to actually take the 12 steps and hopefully to create the enthusiasm necessary for the individual to go out and actually do that. And it stayed in my house for about 3.5 years or so. And then the pastor at this church, who had heard about it, had offered the room here for that purpose. So about 15 months ago or so, we moved in here. And basically what we do is I read out of the Big Book and make comments for about 20 to 40 minutes, depending on what material is involved and where we are in the book. And then we actually go through the room and everybody gets a chance to share. Now with this many people, I would take a guess at 10:15 or so this meeting is going to be over. If anybody needs to leave, you know, if you can't stay that long, please go ahead. You're not going to annoy anybody by leaving. And if you got to move around and get coffee, do that too. I'm going to start by reading something from The Language of the Heart. It's a book written about Bill Wilson's Grapevine writings. And in this paragraph, they're talking about what really is our trouble. It says, "We have since found that the awful conditions of mind and body invariably bring on the third phase of our malady. This is the sickening of the spirit, a sickness for which there must necessarily be a spiritual remedy. We recognize this in the first 5 words of step 12 of the recovery program, having had a spiritual awakening. Here we name the remedy for our threefold sickness of body, mind, and soul. Here we declare the necessity for that all-important spiritual awakening." So actually the treatment for alcoholism and the unmanageability of life, most if not all of our problems is a spiritual awakening. Through my experience in AA and my experience working with others, and I've worked with a lot of others over the years, I found that the strict adherence of the instructions in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous brings on a spiritual change in the individual that follows it to such a degree that they're really reborn in a way. In my own experience, I'm no longer the person I was when I walked through the doors of AA. I could no more sit here and talk like this when I first came in the meetings than, you know, I'd have to commit suicide. I just wouldn't have been able to do it. I'm no longer the person I was when I came in here. I've had a spiritual awakening. I'm not even the type of person I would have liked when I walked into AA. And that has not come about by sitting in AA meetings forever and ever and ever. I've worked with a lot of people who balk at the steps and expect attendance at AA meetings to fix all their problems. And AA activity, which is making coffee or, you know, going to the diner or whatever, that can achieve sobriety for certain lengths of time with people. But the spiritual change that they were talking about in this paragraph, the only way I've seen it manifest is through the practice of spiritual principles like our 12 steps. And that really changes us fundamentally at depth, and we recover from alcoholism and we're given a new power to solve our problems. A number of people are new to this meeting, so with some help of some other people, I've made the decision that rather than keep on going with the 4 practice the principles chapters, which would have taken another 6 weeks probably, you know, the chapter to wives, a vision for you, and all that, we're going to start tonight back on the very, very beginning of the book. And with that, I'm going to start at the preface. I really wish they didn't number these Roman numerals. Somewhere in the 50s, some printer got the idea that it would be a good idea to do the doctor's opinion and the prefaces and everything in Roman numerals. I think that was a bad idea, but anyway. The second paragraph in the preface. Because this book has become the basic text of our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program, that's the first 164 pages, has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for both the second and third editions. The section called The Doctor's Opinion has been kept intact just as it was originally written in 39 by the late William D. Silkworth, our society's great medical benefactor. The only change they made in that is they put the guy's name. When the first edition of the book was published, he didn't want to sign it because it was the doctor's opinion. And he didn't want to get laughed out of his profession by some of the other people. The great thing is that many of his opinions have been proven fact. Just recently, there was an article or something by a physician or physicians who said, you know, everything Dr. Silkworth said is basically right on the money. So we're lucky there. But they have not changed the first 164 pages. I'm very glad of that fact. Even to change the sexist writings and the antiquated vernacular, you know, like our little wifeys, and things like that, you know, they made the decision not even to change that garbage, because to set that precedent could open the door for future revisions, and it works just fine. You know what I mean? Alcoholism has not changed at all since the publication of this book, and the treatment for it hasn't changed either. The second edition added the appendices, the 12 traditions, and the directions for getting in touch with AA. But the chief change was in personal stories. They'll change the personal stories in each edition to more or less allow us to identify more easily. A fourth edition is going to press soon, and they've solicited AA for stories. And they're most likely going to more adequately define the alcoholic of the 90s, if there is such a thing, to allow us to be able to identify better. I just can't wait myself. Forward to the first edition. Those with workbooks are not going to be able to follow this. It's one thing I wish they didn't do with the workbook edition was
they can with the first edition.
What's that?
It's in the workbook. The first edition.
Yeah, the forward to the first edition is in here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The second edition is not.
Okay.
And the third edition.
My mistake. All right, this is the first edition. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. There's our first promise. It says recovered. It does not say recovering. It does not say slowly recovering. It does not say never recovering. It says recovered. The people who put this book together were actively involved in the spiritual principles of the Oxford Group. And one of the things that happens today in AA is you can come to the fellowship and not be exposed to recovery. What happened in the early days was you were exposed to recovery or you were not brought to the fellowship. In many of the groups and early groups, they didn't think you were serious. They didn't think you had an honest desire to stop drinking until you had made some real big inroads into the steps. As a matter of fact, you read some of our earlier history, you'll see that people were going through the steps in a matter of days. Mm-hmm. And you still hear crazy things today in AA, like do a step a year, or you'll know when it's time. you hear all this stuff. And like we say earlier in this meeting, saying this stuff is not an indictment in anybody's program or their recovery or how they got sober, because no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. But what we do in this meeting is we talk about the big book recovery. And there's a lot of things in the fellowship of AA that go at odds with big book recovery. And I'm not afraid to mention some of them. And I don't do that to hurt anybody's feelings. You know, some of us have had sponsors in the past who've said many of these things. And, you know, that's all well and fine, but as long as you want to live. It's okay. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Precisely how we have recovered is in squiggly font. That's important. There was a lot of things that they tried early on in AA, and it didn't promote recovery, like cut back on your meetings, stop working with others, and chase all the newcomers around. They did it, but it didn't work, so they didn't put it in the book. They put the things that worked with recovery in the book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone better to understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we're sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. The idea that the alcoholic was a very sick person was not a popular idea back then. There were things like temperance societies, and where you would sign a pledge. And what we know about alcoholism today is a pledge to not drink. That's like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. You know what I mean? How many pledges have we made? So they really didn't understand that it was a disease. They thought that it was morally corrupt people. It's important that we remain anonymous because we're too few at present to handle the overwhelming number of personal appeals which could result from this publication. Being mostly business or professional folk, we could not well carry on our occupations in such an event. There's a lot of lies in the big book too, and I'm not afraid to point them out either. We're mostly business or professional folks. I think one person worked in the whole New York group when this book was published. One guy had a car and one guy worked. You know, the rest of them were in transition. You know? We would like it all understood that our alcoholic work is an avocation. And an avocation is like a hobby or something you do because you enjoy it. Something that's for free and for fun. When writing or speaking publicly about alcoholism, we urge each of our fellowship to omit his personal name, designating himself instead a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We very earnestly ask the press also to observe this request, for otherwise we shall be greatly handicapped. The press doesn't care much anymore, but up until the present decade, they really were all under the guidance of not to break people's anonymity. People's anonymity get broken all the time today in the press. If it's a good story, they really don't give a damn about our principle of anonymity. So we really have to be on guard against it. We're not an organization in the conventional sense of the word. There are no dues or fees, whatever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. We are not allied with any particular faith, sect, denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. This is the foreword to the first edition, and he's already chipped out in his mind the idea of our traditions. This is a basic skeleton form of a lot of our traditions. Bill Wilson was one of the most far-seeing men that I've ever encountered in my life. He was thinking 20 years ahead of the people around him in the fellowship. After he'd hammered out the traditions, he was working on the concepts of world service, and it took AA, you know, a number of years to catch up to that. It's just amazing when you look at this stuff. It's amazing to me also that he had half the sobriety I have when he put together the architecture for this whole thing. And I've been studying this book for about 8 years now. And every time I go through it, I come across things that it's a new revelation to me. You know what I mean? It's just an amazing thing. We shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results from this book, particularly from those who've commenced work with other alcoholics. We should like to be helpful to such cases. And the inquiry is welcome. This is a forward to the second edition, which is probably not in the workbook. Since the original forward to this book was written in 1939, a wholesale miracle has taken place. Our earliest printing voiced the hope that every alcoholic who journeys will find the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination. Already continues the early text, 2, 3s, and 5s have sprung up in other communities. 16 years have elapsed between our first printing of this book and the presentation in 1955 of our second edition. In that brief space, Alcoholics Anonymous has mushroomed into nearly 6,000 groups whose membership is far above 150,000 recovered alcoholics. Groups are to be found in each of the United States and all of the provinces of Canada. AA has flourishing communities in the British Isles, all over the place. All told, promising beginnings have been made in some 50 foreign countries and U.S. possessions. Many of our friends encourage us by saying that this is but a beginning, only the augury of a much larger future ahead. The spark that was the flare into the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience. Following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford group of that day, he had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is now counted no less than a medical saint by AA members, whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. From this doctor, the broker learned the grave nature of alcoholism. He learned the problem. What is the problem? Why can't I stop drinking? Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced that the need for moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. That's how he got the solution. So the problem and the solution were laid out for him, and then he had a spiritual awakening. Prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic, but he had succeeded only in keeping himself sober. The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. Now, so I think everybody here should know the story of Bill and Dr. Bob's eventful meeting in Akron back then. One of the amazing things is that we're here by seconds and inches. You know what I mean? The story I heard was that he had a pocket full of nickels, and he went up to this church directory, and he was going to call all these church directory people. There's like 10 of them on this list, and try to ask them if they could put him in touch with an alcoholic. And the first 9 people he called, how he approached it was, I'm a rummy from New York, and I'm looking to talk to another rummy. You know, and the next thing he heard probably was click. But what happened was he got a hold of this guy Walter Tunks, who had been exposed to the Oxford group, which he was in the Oxford group at that time. And being exposed to the Oxford group, there was a little bit of the connection there about what he was trying to do. So he put him in touch with Henrietta Cyberling, and it all worked out that he got in touch with Dr. Bob, who had been in the Oxford group longer than he had. And they'll talk about it here. The physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. Mm. So he was going to church, he was involved in the Oxford group, but he was not able to maintain any sobriety. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. Hopefully what we're going to do going through this book and explaining the first step is to allow everybody else here to understand the hopelessness to a point where you will pursue the spiritual remedy, like the drowning will see seize a life preserver. To truly understand the first step, it's like General Custer, there's more Indians coming. You know what I mean? It's like you're dead. The first step says you're dead. It says that once you start drinking, you have no control over where it's going to take you, and it's going to ultimately destroy your body. And your mind tells you that you can't not drink. You are powerless over picking up the first drink. So after he explained this to Dr. Bob, Dr. Bob said, where do I sign up? And that's one of the things we hope to do here in this meeting, generate some enthusiasm to get people to actually take the 12 steps. Because somewhere in AA, I think it was in the 50s or 60s, it became okay to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and not take the steps. It became okay to sit in the back row and suffer for years and years and years and die an alcoholic death, either sober or drinking. Mm. And that is truly a shame. I think that's truly a shame. He sobered up never to drink again up to the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no other alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. Underline vital. Hence, the two men set to work almost frantically upon alcoholics arriving in the ward of Akron City Hospital. Their very first case, a desperate one, recovered immediately and became AA number 3. That's another lie. It was actually their second person that they tried. They tried this one guy, Ernie, who he was a real pip. What did he do? His parents were actually very, very influential in bringing spirituality into the program at the time. They were the ones that distributed the Upper Room. It was a Methodist periodical that people used for morning meditation at that time. Anyway, this guy was Bill Dotson. He was an attorney, and he had blackened a couple nurses' eyes, and he was in a straitjacket. And they brought the solution to him, and he went for it. And I think he actually entered a political race a couple of weeks later after he had recovered, and he almost won. So if they say no major changes in the first year, that's a fellowship suggestion that came from treatment facilities or some shit. Not that I judge. Guy had never had another drink. This work at Akron continued through the summer of 35. There were many failures, but there was an occasional heartening success. When the broker returned to New York in the fall of 35, the first AA group had actually been formed, though no one realized it at the time. By late 37, the number of members having substantial sobriety time behind them was sufficient to convince the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of the alcoholic. They were still ironing out a lot of the things, and they were still losing a lot of people. But there was something like 40 people who had a year sober or more. You know, so that's amazing. Second group had promptly taken shape in New York, and besides, there were scattered alcoholics who had picked up the basic ideas in Akron or New York and were trying to form AA groups in other cities. New Jersey and Cleveland, there was different things going on. It was now time the struggling groups thought to place their message and unique experience before the world. This determination bore fruit in the spring of 39 with the publication of this volume. The membership had then reached about 100 men and women. It says about, I think it was in the 80s. And there was one woman, Florence Rankin, I believe her name was. She was promptly to get drunk before the publication. But it was upon her insistence that it was not titled 100 Men. The fledgling society, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book. The flying blind period ended and AA entered a new phase of its pioneering time. With the appearance of this book, a great deal began to happen. They talk about the Fosdick article. They talk about Rockefeller, going to Rockefeller for money. Bill Wilson was a hell of a promoter, and thank God he was, because that's why we're here. But when he wanted money, he went to Rockefeller, you know. When he wanted psychiatric advice, he went to Jung. I mean, he didn't mess around. XIX, second paragraph down. As we discovered the principles by which the individual alcoholic could live, so we had to evolve principles by which the AA groups and AA as a whole could survive and function effectively. That's the 12 spiritual principles of the traditions and the 12 spiritual principles of the concepts for world service. It was thought that no alcoholic man or woman could be excluded from our society, that our leaders might serve but never govern, that each group was to be autonomous, and there was to be no professional class of therapy. There were to be no fees or dues. Our expenses were to be met by our own voluntary contributions. There was to be the least possible organization, thank God for that, even in our service centers. Our public relations were to be based upon attraction rather than promotion. Our public relations, there's another thing that you hear in the fellowship. Well, I don't go seeking out other alcoholics because it's attraction, not promotion. They've got our public relations policy confused with our 12-step work. Our 12-step work, where we are actively to pursue other still suffering alcoholics. The people that sit in meetings and say they got to come to me are people that are just too lazy to do 12-step work, or else they completely misunderstand our public relations policy. It was decided that all members ought to be anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and films, and in no circumstances should we give endorsements, make alliances, or enter public controversies. This was the substance of AA's 12 traditions, which are stated in full on page 564 of this book. Uh, they talk a little bit more about some of our traditions. The bottom of page XX. Alcohol being no respecter of persons, we're an accurate cross-section of America and in distant lands. The same democratic evening-up process is now going on. By personal religious affiliations, we include Catholic, Protestant, Jews, Hindus, and a sprinkling of Muslims and Buddhists. More than 15% of us are women. I think it's up in the high 40s now. At present, our membership is increasing at the rate of about 7% a year. So far, the total problem of several million actual and potential alcoholics in the world, we've made only a scratch. In all probability, we shall never be able to touch more than a fair fraction of the alcoholic problem and all its ramifications. Upon therapy for the alcoholic himself, we surely have no monopoly. Yet it is our great hope that all those who have as yet found no answer may begin to find one on the pages of this book and will presently join us on a high road to a new freedom. You know, we have a lot of people here tonight. I'm going to stop at the doctor's opinion. I do want to say, though, that one thing that bears mention is the amount of success that they had in early AA. In early AA, there was a huge percentage of people that achieved permanent recovery as far as how many people walked in and tried the AA program. Today, at best, I've heard 8% of the people that walk through the doors of AA get something like a year sober. And you can tell what our success rate is by how many chips the group buys. Our group will buy 10 90-day chips, 8 one-year chips, and every once in a while buy a 20-year chip. You know what I mean? That really says something. In the early days, there was a huge amount of recovery. I believe that because it was always Bill Wilson's fear that AA was going to be watered down. A lot of them were always afraid that AA would be watered down. And today, you can come into AA and find people that have never gotten involved in the Big Book, have never become involved in service, and who can remain in meetings for periods of time, but disappear. Maybe to drink again, maybe to die an alcoholic death through resentment, depression, uneasiness, uncomfortableness, all the signs of untreated alcoholism. But somewhere along the line, when it became okay not to become involved in the recovery program, I believe that's when we started to dip down into the single-digit percentiles as far as recovery rate is concerned. And it's really a shame. And I believe that there's a renaissance going on now in the last few years in AA. And there's some people that are in this room that I know are involved in that are swinging back to the principles that proved so effective in the early days of AA and are trying to bring that back into the fellowship. And I think that's probably the greatest thing that can happen because more people will survive. How many people have we lost in the last 20 years because nobody put a Big Book in front of them? You know, how many people thought AA was just sitting in a chair? And I think that's really changing, and I'm glad that that is. Also, I've found out from the powers that be, because of the amount of attendance at this meeting, after June, we're going to be moving up to the great room upstairs.
Wow.
So we'll have a little bit more room.
Cool.
So we're gonna make do until then, everybody.
Need help setting up chairs.
Anyway, we started at the very, very beginning on the title page last week. Basically, we went through the preface and some of the forewords, which is just basically some information about what AA is. Tonight we're gonna go to the doctor's opinion. In the first edition of the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth did not sign it. One of the interesting things about it was that he was a physician, a chief physician at basically a drug and alcohol hospital back in this time. He had treated many, many thousands of patients before he was asked to write this letter. And one of the amazing things is he's basically going to tell us in his opinion that he can't do anything for us, that the medical fraternity is really powerless over achieving recoveries in the alcoholics of our type. And he's going to, in this, he's going to recommend that you listen to a couple of people who have had what he believed at that time was religious conversion experiences. It would be like going to a brokerage firm and having the chief broker say, don't listen to us. There's a guy down the street flipping coins who's had better success at investing people's money than us. I mean, you know, it's the same type of thing. It's amazing that somebody would put their career kind of on the line by saying that they can't do anything, and a couple of religious fanatics can. So would he have written that down if he didn't believe that it was very, very important to get that information across? I don't think so. Anyway, we'll start at page XXIII. I hate that they do the Roman numerals. That really pisses me off. What I heard was it was a printer's error in the 50s. No one ever gave them permission to change to Roman numerals. A printing company decided that it would be a good idea, and nobody really noticed. And we can't change the big book now. It's almost impossible to vote in big book changes. So we're pretty much stuck with some printer's error from the 50s, and it pisses me off because I have to go XXVVIVX, and nobody knows what the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah, try multiplication.
But not that I judge. The doctor's opinion. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. They put this in the front because in alcoholics, a lot of times don't believe everything that they hear. We're kind of skeptical people. So they figure by putting a doctor's opinion in the very beginning, that will get our attention. Convincing testimony must surely come from the medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician in a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcohol and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 34, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of the type I had come to regard as hopeless. So there is a type of alcoholic that the medical fraternity regards as hopeless. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. Basically, this is what Ebbie Thatcher came and told him, that he had got religion. He had turned his will and his life over to Jesus in the Oxford group. So Bill Wilson starts running around telling everybody that you have to turn your will and your life over to Jesus, is what he was doing at this time. They later took a lot of the Jesus terminology out of the book, basically to open the door a little wider. Because I don't know about anybody else, but if you would have come up to me when I was brand new and shaken myself sober and said, your answer is Jesus, I would have said, no, I don't think so. It couldn't possibly be. I guess I'll have to go and die. So by opening the door, they saved my ass, I'll tell you, because I had some real prejudices against the people who were pushing Jesus. I saw them on the TV taking widows' pension money and stuff, and I wasn't real happy with them. I thought they were hypocritical. I've since been able to put aside those prejudices, though. Thank goodness, most of them at least. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered ED. I personally know scores of cases who were the type with whom other methods failed completely. Mm-hmm. His methods, medical methods. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. So he got to know some of the first 100 enough to know that they're not full of shit, that something really is actually going on. And it says, yours truly, William D. Silkworth, and it did not say that. I think it said XXXXX or something. Well, what did it say in the first edition?
It says a blank line.
Blank line. Okay. I always got the impression that this wasn't a letter good enough for Bill Wilson. It didn't really say the things that he wanted the medical fraternity to express to us. So I always get the feeling that he went back to Silkworth and said, come on, give me a better letter than that, for God's sake. Because it says here, the physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Mm. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life and that we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent. In fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, and you all know who you are. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. And back then, this was an opinion of his, or a theory of his. It's since been proved, and I'm certainly not qualified to talk on it, but Joe and Charlie and some other people do a nice job about talking about what happens with our physical craving. Alcohol breaks down into acetone, and the acetone stays. It doesn't get metabolized quick enough with alcoholics, and the acetone creates a craving for more acetone, and that's really what is different about our bodies. And anybody that doesn't know what acetone is, you can buy it in an auto parts store. It's what gets tar off of your car fender. It's a solvent, and it's dissolved a lot of things besides tar. It's dissolved families and careers and everything else in alcoholics, I'll tell you. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Why do you drink like a maniac when every time you wake up in a detox or something? I mean, how can you account for that? Well, you know what I mean? And a lot of times we don't understand really what's going on with our drinking. We protect it. We get into denial. We cover it up. Or we blot it out of our mind. But really, why does an alcoholic drink when we get DWIs, we lose families, we wake up in Topeka with one shoe? Why do we keep picking up booze?
Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome, Jeff. I certainly wasn't pointing any fingers. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane, and altruistic is just another word for unselfish, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. And another thing, I still favor hospitalization for the jittery and befogged. Here's a statistic for you. 15% of alcoholics, their progression gets to a point where they suffer delirium tremens. 15% of the alcoholics that suffer delirium tremens die from them. Okay, so if you're trying to sober up somebody, you're locking them in the closet in the basement or something, you could very well be contributing to somebody's death. What happens is our blood pressure goes up to 2 million over 60, and probably the main thing that happens is our aorta explodes like a garden hose. And that'll void your warranty right there. And, you know, we either die of stroke or heart attack during DTs. That's one of the main ways we go. So none of the closet detoxing. I'm not advocating rehabs, but I have advocated detoxes in the past. The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. So he at least in 1935, he was on the crest of the alcoholic treatment wave. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on the subject, which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. Now, I'm going to change some of the words here, because you got to understand that Silkworth was not a God guy, and he really had a hard time expressing spiritual principles. So it's hard to understand this next paragraph unless some of the words are changed, because, you know, he couldn't talk about God. He beat around the bush. So I'm going to change it a little. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of spiritual experience was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our doctors' conception. What with the medical ultra-modern standards and the doctor's scientific approach to everything, we doctors are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. How is an MD going to give you a spiritual experience? It's not in the cards. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. And those were some of the precepts of the Oxford group. There was basically three main things that Bill Wilson became very, very convinced of. He became convinced of restitution, confession, guidance, all kinds of things like that, and he put them into work. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgivings, we consented. I love that sentence. Requested the privilege of carrying the message into an institution, and with some misgivings, they consented. You know, nowadays, they can't get enough good AA people into the institutions to carry the message. They're stealing our literature, for God's sake. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. The power of God they're talking about here. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological methods can be of maximum benefit. You know, get somebody detoxed. It's hard to start bringing somebody through the steps when they're still drunk. And has anybody here ever gone on a 12-step call and the person didn't even remember you showing up? You know? I'll tell you, I have. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, and that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. The phenomenon of craving is the second drink calls very strongly for the third drink. The third drink calls very strong for the fourth drink. The fourth drink calls very strong for the fifth drink, and you wake up in a crack house in Harlem. Again, I'm not pointing any. Again, I'm not pointing any fingers. That's the phenomenon of craving, okay? And it Aunt Fanny does not have three drinks and show up in New York City naked. You know what I mean? It just doesn't happen. The phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon of craving only happens in heavy drinkers or alcoholics. It does not happen in the moderate or temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence or their ability to control, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Does anyone here relate to problems piling up on them that have become astonishingly difficult to solve? Join the club. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Oh, please stop drinking for me. No way. Even sure, honey. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. Mm-hmm. And I really try to have depth and weight with my message. I don't say, just don't drink even if your ass falls off. Have a seat and get a coffee. That's not the message that I try to portray anymore. I try to really have a message with depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. So this is a doctor saying you got to get God. It's amazing. If any feel as psychiatrists directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, you know, telling you to go to God, let them stand with us a while on the firing line, see the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solvings of these problems become part of their daily work, even their sleeping moments. Mm. I mean, he's telling you that he's waking up with nightmares about some of the shit that he's seeing, the families and stuff. And the most cynical will not wonder why we have accepted it and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the unselfish movement now growing up among them. Mm. That's an amazing statement for a doctor to make. But he's saying, why do you think I'm making it? Just come to work with me one day and see the absolute torture that's going on with these families. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. Hmm. A lot of people I work with early on, they can't distinguish the truth from the false. It's amazing. They'll say something like, I'll do anything to get over alcohol. I'll do anything. Just tell me what to do. Go to a meeting tomorrow night. Oh, I can't. I'm busy. They can't differentiate the truth from the false. You know what I mean? You need to take the steps in your life. You need to practice the principles of this program to survive. Well, I'm going to hang out on step one for 6 months. You know? It's just amazing. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Here's a great sentence. This is the untreated alcoholic. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others take. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Mm. Has anyone ever hear, you know, the hounds of hell have been ripping at your ass and you're just sick of it, God damn it, and I'm going to a liquor store, you know? I want that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by buying a bottle of vodka and drinking it down and going into a blackout.
Thanks, Chris.
Not that I'm pointing any fingers. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, that means like once you get started, you're in it for the whole deal, the beast is awake, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for recovery. Mm. How about the relapser? You know, coming to their senses again and rushing back into AA. I'm ready this time. But they're not really ready, and then they go back out again. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, and he's talking about the spiritual awakening that comes after we practice the 12 steps, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. The rules are our principles or our steps. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that it is in him, it's often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to provide the essential psychic change. Mm. You know, if you go to doctors today, very few of them are going to say, I can't do anything for you. The good doctors will refer you to a spiritual program. Some of the doctors that really don't understand alcoholism will have 14 different drugs they'll put you on. One of the latest people that we were working with got put on a new drug that's to combat obsessive-compulsive disorders. And the doctor said to this woman that we were working with, alcoholism is an obsessive-compulsive disorder. Take these pills, you'll be fine. Don't worry about that AA crap. So while we were dragging her off to detox like 3 or 4 days later, we let her know that, you know, you may have been misdiagnosed. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we've made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological process. I do not hold with those that believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've seen many men who had, for example, worked for a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to that date. Then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. Mm. I'll give you one out of my personal experience. I walked practically the entire 80s. And in early 1989, I had finally done everything I needed to do to get my license back, my driver's license back. They'd found out about DWIs from Florida. It was just a mess. And anybody in here that can relate to nightmarish Trenton hassles to get your license back, I actually had to take my driver's test over again. It was me and 32 17-year-olds taking the driver's test. I felt like an idiot. But anyway, I finally had all my ducks in a row, and I was going to Wayne to get my license back. And I always had problems going to authority places, you know, places with, like, authority figures. So I had a couple of drinks before I went. So I had a few vodkas. Well, I went to sit down in front of this woman who was, I was real pissed off. I went in there and I go, I got this. And I'm throwing all the paperwork down. I finally got them. You know, they got to give me my license back. And she starts sniffing at me. She's like sniffing at me. She goes, you've been drinking. I go, no. And she goes, you smell like vodka. And so you know, I'm lying. I'm saying it's like last night. I must still smell from last night. I was celebrating getting my license back. And finally, I give her all the stuff, and she's got to hand me the one piece of paper that's going to get me my license back. And she hands it to me, but she won't let go. It was like a tug of war. She's like trying to protect humanity from me. Now, what a stupid thing to do, to get your license back from it was my third DWI, and I'm getting my license back from my third DWI, and I'm drunk getting my license back. Now, if mental control helped with alcoholism, would I have done something so stupid? Another one was I missed my daughter's baptism. I got drunk and I missed it. I sent one of my buddies who pretended he was me. Would I miss my own daughter's baptism if alcoholism was a problem in mental control?
Yeah. Did it fool your wife?
My wife wasn't, you know, she knew I wasn't me, but it wasn't like the priest was real familiar with me, you know. He bought it. Anyway. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion is that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. Important warning flag. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About a year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partly recovered from a gastric hemorrhage that seemed to be, and he seemed to be in a case of pathological mental deterioration. I sponsor people like that. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He wasn't wet-brained. He accepted the plan outlined in this book, The Steps. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but all resemblances ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck, he had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and deciding his situation hopeless, he had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, his detoxing, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort unless I could assure him, which no one had ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. Ooh. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, or a spiritual awakening, or a conversion experience, whatever you want to call it. And we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He's not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one would want to wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. That's really something for a non-God guy to say. I want to start off tonight reading a little bit out of the step book, which is not something that I normally do. I've probably been to enough step meetings to have read the step book through at least 150 times, the first part of the 12 and 12. And I've done enough big book studies to be able to say that I've been through the big book at least 60 or 80 times. And what I've come out of that with is an understanding of what they're both about. And I'll tell you what, although I think there's really a lot of wonderful material in the step book, I think it pales in comparison with the amount of wonderful insight for alcoholism and alcoholism recovery that's laid out in the big book. It says here on page 17 of the foreword, the book Alcoholics Anonymous became the basic text of the fellowship and still is. This present volume proposes to broaden and deepen the understanding of the 12 steps as first written in the earlier work. One of the big mistakes I made in early recovery was figuring I'll learn how to do the steps and I'll get motivated to do the steps by going to step meetings. And that's really not what happened with me. I became more confused by going to step meetings about how to work the steps than I would have if I didn't even bother. See, I didn't understand the principles that were in the big book, so how could I broaden and deepen them? Today I understand a little bit about what the step book's talking about, but I've got personal experience with the steps now. I think it can be very, very confusing to have a newcomer read the step book. So I usually don't encourage that until someone has some personal experience with the literature in the big book. Tonight we're going to go over the first half of Bill's story. The way I like to look at Bill's story is as a 12-step call in print. There's a couple of reasons why Bill's story is the first chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and Dr. Bob's is way at the back, and it's not really even a chapter. I think one of them had to do with Bill's ego. I think that he had a monstrous ego, and we can be very, very grateful for his promotional abilities and his ego and stuff, because I'll tell you what, when they wanted to go for money, they went to the Rockefellers. When they wanted psychiatric advice, they went to Carl Jung. And it takes a giant ego to be able to do that stuff. And you know, he was marvelously effective at running the New York office and getting AA off the ground as far as all the administrative tasks and all that came to be. But I think the second reason why Bill's story is in the beginning is it was really the best of the first stories. I've read all of the first stories in the first edition, and Bill's story is by far the best. It covers more areas that really need to be covered when talking about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So the way I like to break Bill's story down is in the first eight pages are basically what happened and what it was like, the drinking experiences, and heading toward the bottom, his alcoholic bottom. And the second half of the story is where he became willing, and he found out some things, and he became willing to recover from alcoholism, and he took some steps and did some work to recover from alcoholism. So what we'll do tonight is we'll basically cover the first half. One of the exercises I give the people that I work with, newcomers or people that are unfamiliar with step work, so I give them the exercise of identify with Bill's story the first half. In other words, highlight or underline anything that you identify with drinking, thinking, or feeling or doing that Bill did, thought, felt, or whatever. I'm not going to read every word of this, but I'm going to kind of pick out some things that I definitely identify with. You know, this really is a 12-step story in print. And I think the more we identify with Bill Wilson, the better able we'll be to understand that we too are alcoholic, and we too have felt this way. And the solution that Bill Wilson and the First 100 practiced is something that will work for us too. Paragraph 1-1 down at the bottom says he was very lonely and he turned again to alcohol. I identify with that because I drank when I was lonely. That was one of the reasons why I would drink. He talks about coming back from World War I. Over on page 2 at the top, says he took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. Down at the bottom of the paragraph, he said, "We had long talks when I would still her forebodings about my drinking by telling her that men of genius conceived their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophical thought were so derived. What a crock of shit." And I can relate to that so much because my personal one was, I drink because all people with dark, artistic, misunderstood, complicated personalities, you know, have to calm down their jagged nature, you know. That was my line of shit. But I think we all have that. It says here, by the time I had completed the course, I knew that the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. So the guy is right there at the final graduation point of a law degree, and he decides, ah, to hell with it. Does anybody in here relate to almost doing it and then saying to hell with it right at the end? I'll tell you, I did. I changed my majors as much as I changed my underwear. And I have actually like 150 college credits, and I don't even have an associate's degree. Because I kept changing my major all the time, you know. I have like 200 credits in science fiction and swimming, you know. Anyway, he jumps on a motorcycle with his wife and he runs off. Actually, what he did was he became one of the first stock analysts. At that time, people were just taking paperwork and making their investment decisions based on paperwork that they got about companies. And he said, why don't I go out and talk to these companies and find out if they're for real, and that way when we invest our money, you know, it'll be a better bet. So what he actually would do is he would go to the bar that's right next to the factory, and he would drink with the factory workers, and he'd get them to talk. And that's the way he would find out the real deal about these companies. And he was very successful at it when he wasn't in a blackout. So for the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seizing and swelling. Here's one. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. Drink started to take an important and exhilarating part in my life when I first started drinking it, I'll tell you. I used it for a social tool. I used it for all kinds of things. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The arguments of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. Same thing happened with me. If there was anybody that was still friends with me and still drinking like me, they were completely insane. Because I was violent toward the end of my drinking. You never knew what I was going to do, and I was real bad luck. You'd hang out with me, and you would end up getting a DWI because of something I did. You know, I was just really bad luck toward the end, and I ended up being a lone wolf. The only people that would still hang out with me were like high school buddies who would come into town once a year for Christmas to see their parents or something, and they would make the mistake of hanging out with me. And it didn't happen too often. He begins to get jittery in the morning down at the bottom of page 4.
He ends up losing like a million jobs, and I can relate to that too. I had like 13 jobs in 10 years. He gets this one last chance, and it's really, this is after the stock market crash, and it's a guy up in Canada who again didn't really know the extent of Bill's drinking because he was sheltered up in Canada. So Bill goes up there, he makes an absolute solemn pledge: I will not drink. And he puts it in writing. You know, if I ever take so much as a drop of alcohol, you can fire me and all this stuff. And what happens? He ends up getting as drunk as six Billy goats on the guy, and they fire him. You know, he had to uphold his part of the contract. So his last opportunity with a Canadian financial company is down. So it says, drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time we stayed broke. We went to live with my wife's parents. Good God. I found a job and then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Has anyone in here ever brawled with a taxi driver? That's even something that I've done. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. My wife, during the 12 happy months that I was married, had to... she was working, and I was sitting at home smoking bones and watching Love Boat reruns. I was like too stoned to go get a job, you know. Honey, did you go look for a job today? Yeah, God, it's hell out there, though. There's really nothing out there for me. And when she was finally 9 months pregnant and had to quit work, and I finally did have to get a job. That's the kind of guy I was. Sacrifices. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Ooh. Bathtub gin. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin followed by a half a dozen bottles of beer would be required if I was to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Can you imagine having to drink that much just to eat breakfast? Mm-hmm. And thinking you're in control. That's complete insanity. He's heading for the bottom here. His house, the house was taken over by a mortgage holder. The mother-in-law died. Yeah, it's just really tragic. He suffered from bad breaks and misunderstandings. I woke up. This had to be stopped. Listen to this. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. He got that part of the first step. He can't take one drink. So with that self-knowledge, he should be okay, right? Well, shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Here again, the guy is almost, he's really close to death from alcoholism. He's drinking himself to death, and he knows as soon as he starts drinking, it's over, and he can be in it for as long as the deal lasts. So why did he shortly afterward come home drunk again? I mean, he hadn't even thought, like, I better not take a drink. This is an example of the powerlessness over alcohol. I had signed myself into a rehab. I was in the middle of an outpatient treatment program. I'm paying mega thousands of dollars for this shit. I told everybody in my life that I was now sober and everything was going to be better. And I ended up getting drunk one time on the way to an AA meeting. Mm. I decided that it would be a good idea to buy a gallon of vodka and drink it. There wasn't really any even thought of that it would send me back out for like 8 more months of torture. It was like, this sounds like a good idea. That's the insanity. That's the obsession of the mind. And he just doesn't really understand it at this point in time in his story. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. So now he's got a period of sobriety. I think it was about 6 months or 4 months of sobriety, and he's starting to think, you know, I got this thing licked. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it had happened. Mm. The exact story of this was, he went to play golf one day. There was no job prospects on the horizon, so he decided to take the day off and go play golf. He borrowed some money from Lois, and he went to the golf course. And at the golf course, he stopped at the bar to get a soda. And at the bar, he met somebody, and they kind of became friendly, and he was talking with this guy. And he told the guy all about his alcoholism. He told him his whole story. He said, you know, this is what happens when I drink. And a few minutes later, he asked the bartender for a cocktail.
No.
He
got the cocktail for free. They were being good
customers. Oh, that's right. It was
Armistice Day.
Exactly. It was Armistice Day. And they were passing out free drinks. So he goes, sure, I'll take it. And he starts drinking. And the guy looks at him. The guy looks at him and goes, you got to be out of your mind after what you just told me. You know? As the whiskey rose in my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then. And that's another thing that I relate to. I used to do that.
Right.
Well, you know, I slipped, so I might as well have a good time with it. The remorse, horror, hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. Ooh. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. Does anybody relate to your brain racing uncontrollably? And that sense of impending calamity?
Mm-hmm.
It's usually because your brain is racing and there's calamity impending. down at the bottom. Should I kill myself? No, not now. The mental fog settled down. Jen would fix that. Two bottles and oblivion. And that's something I drank for toward the end too. Just get me out of now.
Right.
I want to get out of Chris. I want to drink as much as I can to just forget. I just want to go into oblivion land. I just wanted to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms for mine endured this agony. Two more years, sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. I used to have a loaded .38, and I would get into that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and I would put it to my head, and I would curse myself for a weakling for not being able to pull a trigger. Because I'll tell you what, if I didn't have to die to kill myself, I would have done it. You know? But it just seemed like maybe it was a little extreme. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. I love this part. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leave. He lives like on the fifth floor of an apartment building, and here he is dragging his mattress past the neighbors down to the lobby to sleep. You know, hey Bill, what are you doing? Well, I'm afraid I'm going to jump out the window, so I'm going to sleep outside your door. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. Everybody that's drank both gin and sedative, raise their hand. I mean, I was Xanax and whiskey myself. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight.
Right.
My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Somebody came into high school one time with a sack of belladonna. And it's this like hallucinogenic weed or something. It's like this poisonous herb. Mm-hmm. And he started selling it. And I don't know about anybody else, but I was the kind of guy that I'd go, yeah, give me that. Gulp. What was that? You know? And what this stuff did to me and others was it made us partially blind and we felt psychotic. And that's what it did. I can't imagine it being a treatment for alcoholism. But here we were the next day, you know, hey, did you go blind too? It was fucked up. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise help much. Hydrotherapy is where they strap you to a gurney and they put you into a big shower with all kinds of spidgets. They hit you with hot water, cold water, hot water, cold water. I don't know if it'd help you overcome your alcoholism, but it'd drive you out of your mind. I guess it'd clean you up a little. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill both bodily and mentally. This is Dr. Silkworth, who's about to give Bill Wilson an explanation of his problem. Until this period of time, Bill Wilson did not know why he kept picking up the first drink. I mean, it's pretty academic that once you start drinking, you know, you're a blackout drinker, you just keep drinking and drinking and drinking. That's the easy part to understand. The hard part to understand is, why do you keep picking up the first drink? What the fuck's wrong with you? You know, if you end up in the hospital or, I mean, if every time you pick up a drink, what do you say to yourself? You have to drink on a lie. You have to say, well, it won't hurt me this time, because you can't say, oh, I think I'll go and get a bottle of whiskey, get a divorce, burn the top half of my house down, and go to the hospital for a month. I mean, that's not what you say before you have a drink, but that's what happens to you. So he just doesn't understand. Silkworth gave him the explanation of the obsession of the mind. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. Mm. So our willpower, when it comes to alcohol, can be at best inefficient. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. So knowing that you suffer from a mental obsession, you would think, okay, now that I know, I'll be all right. But that's not true. You're powerless over alcohol. If you can decide not to drink, you're not powerless over alcohol. Because if you can decide not to drink, you have power over alcohol. So it's the mental obsession that really makes us powerless. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My wearying, despairing wife was informed that it would all end in heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker of the asylum. A wet brain basically is a dry brain. Has anyone here ever come to the next day so parched that you have to drink like a half a gallon of water? Yeah. Well, what happens is, repeatedly, when you do that to your system and get that dehydrated, it dries out your brain, and your brain just kind of dies. And that's really the form of alcoholic insanity, wet brain. Because what happens is you can survive for years. There's people that have lived in Greystone Hospital for 30 years with wet brain, and all they do is drool. And their family comes every Christmas and he brings them a flower or something and asks them, do you recognize me, Uncle Jim? You know, and of course they don't, because they've checked out. You know, that's what happens with wet brain. And the undertaker of the asylum, that's real nice news, you know. Well, Mrs. Wilson, you know, you better buy a grave plot for your husband. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What I would not give to make amends, but that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity, quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. He probably got a couple weeks in. Then came that insidious insanity of the first drink on Armistice Day. That's what I was talking about before. I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. So there is kind of some hope here. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen with a certain satisfaction. I reflected that there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that day and the next. My wife was at work, and I wondered whether I'd dare hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. All right. Tonight, to start off, I'd have asked Rich to read a piece of literature. This piece of literature is an early preamble from the 40s. It's an AA group preamble. And anybody that knows me knows I'm very, very fond of the real old literature.